You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
When BP's Deepwater Horizon oil rig exploded in April of 2010, releasing some 4.9 million barrels of oil into the Gulf of Mexico over 3 months, thousands of reporters descended on Gulf communities to assess the damages and find a culprit. Greg Pallast, who writes for The Guardian and is a BBC correspondent, was one of them. But his search took him to places like Azerbaijan, Alaska, Ecuador, and Greece. Mr. Pallast's new book, Vulture's Picnic, is published by Dutton. I'm very pleased that it has brought him back to our show. And this is an odd book because it also comes with interactive videos.
That's right. This is the, if you get Vulture's Picnic, the amplified, enhanced, or whatever the heck they're calling it, the souped up, fancy ass, whatever, is you get a video that begins each chapter, and I read the beginning. So you can.
That's only on the ebook version?
It's hard. If you try to press one of the paper pages, it just doesn't turn into a movie. But actually, what I've done is so that the Gutenberg crowd doesn't miss a thing, you get the hardbound of Vulture's Picnic. You go to vulturespicnic.org. It says the films, and you can get those films there.
Did this book also grow out of your previous one, Armed Madhouse, which also dealt with oil, but in that case, Iraq?
You know, Armed Madhouse, The Best Democracy Money Can Buy. Those were actually my investigative reports for BBC. You know, like how Catherine Harris knocked off thousands of black voters off the voter rolls. You know, that was my story about the fake felon list. The oil fields of Iraq, the plans for the oil fields. That was Armed Madhouse. This takes you on the investigation. It's quite different than the others in that you're actually with me when I'm getting inside BP's underpants and Goldman Sachs and the rest of the characters.
And what ties it all together? The fact that you describe all of these people as vultures and beasts?
What ties it together is my resentment and hatred of the 1%, and that I spent my entire life getting even with these guys because I was stuck in a hole in the Chicano neighborhoods in Los Angeles, marked as a loser. They wanted me to go to Vietnam if I didn't get a bullet in my head. I was supposed to go work at the Chevy plant, which gets closed anyway. I don't like these people, and unlike other reports, I'm not trying to be objective. I'm trying to get in their face and expose them.
Is that why you work in Britain rather than the United States?
Yeah, well, I do something in Britain called investigative reporting, which, as you know, Lenny, is against Patriot Act 3 in the United States, so it's not done here anymore. I mean, this old-fashioned gumshoe, stake out, get inside the file cabinets, investigative reporting, which, you know, it literally isn't done anymore in the U.S.
Well, you weave parts of your father's life story into the narrative. What led you to include him?
Well, he dies in the middle of the investigations. I had to think a lot about his life and mine, and he died a coward. I'm being very straight about it, that difficult for him to face life because what he wanted to do, he knew that there were these bad, evil things out there. And he wanted me to take those on. So he sent me forth to slay the dragons. I thought that was pretty darn cruel of him. But, you know, on the other hand,
it has led to a nice career.
Well, for me, yeah. I feel sad for his life not lived. So I'm living his life and mine. That's why I end up in the middle of the Amazon rainforest. Soup's Creek with a hand-carved paddle and a dugout log, right?
You often ask your interview subjects the courage question, which is invariably something about their father. What do you think that the answer to this question tells us about someone?
You know, it was originally an investigation of BP and the nuclear industry after Fukushima and getting inside these guys. But what I found is that ultimately it ended up being a history of biographies of courageous people. The sources. People are always saying, oh, aren't you always in danger? Don't you worry for your life? No. My sources. When I get a guy from floating in a ship in the Caspian Sea in the middle of a dictatorship who says, I have the information on BP and the Deepwater Horizon, I mean, this guy is taking a chance that he's going to be spending his life in the bottom of a dungeon with his fingernails ripped out.
And the Caspian Sea, because BP is there as well?
Yeah. So what happens is, the Deepwater Horizon explodes, and I get a cable from a ship floating in the Caspian Sea that says, you know, I know what's going on here, but I can't talk on the official IT system. I set up a secure line and find out that, in fact, according to this source, who is an eyewitness, that there was a blowout identical to the BP Deepwater Horizon blowout on a BP rig in the Caspian Sea same rig, also Transocean, and same cause, the cheap crap cement that they use because it saves money, and they covered it up. This is a very, very serious charge, so I had to get my way into Azerbaijan to get the real story.
But it didn't lead to the same kinds of destruction.
Well, it led
to destruction. It did lead to some destruction.
Well, it led to the Deepwater Horizon.
They had paid attention to what had happened in the Caspian Sea, we wouldn't have had Deepwater?
Well, it's not a matter of pay attention. If they didn't lie, cover up, bribe, beat up people and BP executives perjured themselves before the United States Congress 6 months before the Deepwater Horizon blows, Lenny. They say, well, we don't have problems with this type of drilling and methods. The other oil company said the same, and they knew all about what happened in the Caspian Sea, which is the same problem, which they deliberately covered up, including their SEC documents. So basically you go from the Deepwater Horizon being a tragedy, an accident, to being a homicide that is a negligent, willful act of negligence.
Now, this area, what used to be part of the Soviet Union, now independent Azerbaijan. Well, the Caspian actually is on Iran as well, and
yep.
Russia. It had borders on a number of different countries.
Yep.
Didn't Amoco have first dibs on the Caspian's oil fields?
Uh-huh.
How did BP wind up with those rights?
That's part of the story. We find out. We go speak to two MI6 agents, ex-agents. One of them, by the way, is a current member of parliament. The other is a man who's frankly dying, so he gave us his deathbed. I wouldn't call it confession, but boast about a massive bribery that they paid to the government of Azerbaijan, BP, to get the contract away from Amoco, and using Babes bribery beatings. The Babes are Lord Brown, CEO of British Petroleum, BP, would send in his 727 jet, pick up the Azeri officials, and take them to London for a weekend of lap dancing, away from the Islamic Republic. But then when that didn't work, they armed the ex-KGB chief of this ex-Soviet Republic, who then there was a coup d'etat, and, suddenly 3 months after the coup d'etat, British Petroleum gets an exclusive contract to drill the Azeri Caspian Sea. Amoco makes out because BP then pays a premium for Amoco to buy their love and buy them out.
Why didn't Azeri businesses get the rights to build all the equipment for the wells? Isn't that a typical requirement in a deal like this?
Yeah, it's called bakshish, massive, massive, massive bribery. And Halliburton and Hughes were given the contracts, and so what happens is that these guys Azerbaijan was the biggest oil center in the world for making oil equipment. Now there's like 90% unemployment in that area, 90%. And that's because the contracts, because of the bribery and the payoffs, never went to the local people.
Who's Leslie Abraham? He's one of the brave people you were talking about.
Yeah, well, the bag man. I wouldn't call him in the list of the courageous necessarily.
But
because he's confessional, right. Oh. He was the guy who literally carried the bag of $30 million for Lord Brown, with Lord Brown. He didn't just go in himself. Lord Brown, Lady Thatcher flew into Azerbaijan, $30 million in a briefcase. Lord Brown hands it off to the president. And by the way, I'm saying some pretty wild things here, right? Do understand, I'm working for BBC Television, The Guardian, and the Channel 4 Dispatch, as it's called. We have to, under British law, the libel law requires us to give all this evidence to BP for their response. Did BP deny the bribery? No. Did they deny that there was a cover-up, a massive cover-up of a deadly blowout? No. Did they all the coup d'etat? No. All they said was we followed the rules.
Well, Greg, you were doing this in Great Britain. Are you promising me that you weren't checking out anybody's cell phone voicemail or...
Actually, one thing I do is I follow all the laws scrupulously, but my job is to get inside. So I have, I have a lot of documents to say not for public exposure, not for, confidential secret all throughout the book. By the way, that's in the public interest. Getting the secret documents in the public interest is not a violation of law. Getting them for titillation to find out what the, in fact, actually one of the guys who goes after me is one of the guys who did the phone tapping. Was a guy who's known in Britain as Puss Moron, but here it goes by the name of Piers Morgan, who sets me up with some Well, actually, I set myself up, but you know, he made a big splash.
And now
out
he's
of
a
it.
Big star in this country on
yeah.
CNN.
Yeah, of course, of course.
Greg Pelless is the author of bestsellers, Armed Madhouse, and The Best Democracy Money Can Buy. His latest is called Vulture's Picnic, In Pursuit of Petroleum, Pigs, Power Pirates, and High Finance Carnivores. It's published by Dutton. Let's just stay in the Caspian for a few moments
sure.
longer and then move on to other places. The problem for BP in both the Caspian and in the Gulf was something, a nitrogen cement, wasn't it?
Yeah, it's just, you know, what they do is Halliburton made up this mixture. BP uses it. It just is quick set cement. Every day on a rig that you rented is about from Transocean, about $500,000. So time is money, time is money. Let's do it quick. So we use quick set cement. Unfortunately, in underwater, in deep water or midwater drilling, this stuff don't work. It's given to failure, and when it fails and blows out, it's pretty deadly. And they knew. See, the problem is.
Well, they knew the problem because of the Caspian problem.
Yeah, they knew it. And so did, by the way, the other oil company buddies of theirs who complained to our State Department, where's our money from the Caspian Sea? BP won't tell us what's going on. They get a hint, but they covered up because the last thing they want to do, remember, they were not allowed until November of 2009 to even drill deep water in the Gulf of Mexico because it's considered just too dangerous. They knew it was too dangerous.
The Caspian Sea has all the sturgeon that supplied the world with caviar no longer
it did.
Doing that, partly because of the pollution or just simply because the sturgeon were overfished?
They didn't want to do it anymore, the sturgeon. Yeah. It was just – it's a toxic toilet.
The White House Oil Spill Commission's January 2011 report on the Deepwater Horizon spill states that, I'm quoting, the root causes are systemic and absent significant reform in both industry practices and government policies might well recur. So has your research turned up any information about whether BP has been taking reformative actions?
Yeah, I have a lot of information on that. They haven't. They've been putting on what's called a cleanup theater. And, you know, so it's a reform theater. It's all about supposedly their culture of lack of safety. Come on. In fact, one of the stories in there is very sickening to me, especially with this question of the XL pipeline going from Canada to Houston. There is, in every pipeline, there's a robot pig. When this pig squeals, it has little wires and lasers, but little wires, and finds corrosion leaks when the pipe's going to explode. That's what keeps these pipelines safe. Now, BP has the big Trans-Alaska pipeline. Now, there's the XL pipeline. We find out here that the pig has been silenced. It doesn't squeal when things go bad.
Now, can you explain these pigs better?
Yeah, pigs in the pipeline. In fact, there's a chapter in Vulture's Picnic called Pigs in the Pipeline.
I was going to get to it.
Okay.
We might as well talk about it now.
Okay. I didn't know that. Tell me the order. Every pipeline has a pig, and I don't mean like Lord Brown getting sucked in. I'm talking about this robot, which looks like a pig, just kind of big and metal. You stick it into the pipe, and you run it through. That's how they know a pipe is safe, because they can't stick the executive in there, no matter what we would like. And this metal pig, it's a robot. It has whiskers, and it goes off, and it beeps and boops and squeals if the pipe is going to leak or crack or explode. The problem is, I find out from a guy we have to call Pigman One from one source that the pig has been silenced, so it won't squeal when things are gone. For a good reason, because every time it squeals, under the law, the regulations are very specific. That pipe has to be removed, fixed, replaced at $1 million a mile. So it's like taking the batteries out of your smoke detector. That's okay unless you have a fire. And you know, you asked me about stories of courage. We couldn't get these software engineers to say that the pigs had been fixed not to squeal until 9 people were burnt alive in San Bruno when a pipeline exploded. Two of our sources ran for the hills because they don't want to be involved in, frankly, a homicide, right? One guy stood up and said, I will talk to you about the pig. He said, 9 people were killed. It's not academic. You know, we fixed that software. We knew that the software wasn't warning people, and 9 people are dead.
And where was that?
That was San Bruno, California, just this past year. So he came forward. I mean, we still show him in shadow, but we have the information. And by the way, again, took it to BP and said, tell us it's wrong.
My guest is Greg Pelless, who is the author of the international bestsellers, The Best Democracy Money Can Buy, an Armed Madhouse. He is a correspondent for the BBC, for The Guardian, and in fact, BBC's Newsnight. The Guardian, also write for Rolling Stone, Harper's, and
once in a while.
And his latest book is called Vulture's Picnic, In Pursuit of Petroleum, Pigs, Power, Pirates, and High Finance Carnivores. It is published by Dutton. And when we come back, we'll talk a bit about the high finance carnivores and more about the petroleum and whatever else we can get to. Stay with us. We're back with Greg Palast, P-A-L-A-S-T. His latest book, Vulture's Picnic, In Pursuit of Petroleum, Pigs, Power, Pirates, and High Finance Carnivores. And maybe we could talk a bit about the high finance carnivores.
Yum.
You say that you don't buy what we've been told about Greece, that its economy blew apart because of a bunch of lazy Greeks who refused to put in a full day's work, retire while they're still very young, and receive large pensions. And that's what led the government to spend large amounts of social services using borrowed money. And so when the bill came due, the Greeks were told that they had to pay with higher taxes and cuts in their welfare state, they rioted. That's not true?
No. You know, the line is it's a bunch of ouzo, swilling, olive pit spitting Greeks who are too lazy to get to work. And they borrowed a bunch of money from Germans. Now they don't want to pay it back. Uh-uh. Greece is a crime scene, okay? Greece is a crime scene. And by the way, you know, I was a student, Milton Friedman, so I know how this stuff started. And Greece
would he have approved?
He would have loved it. Creative destruction, Schumpeter. He was, you know, just like Thomas Friedman. They love this stuff. Fire is these guys pick up, you know, they make profits at the fire sales, so they like fires. So, and here's what happened. It's a crime scene, Greece. For 10 years, the Greek governments were running a scam with Goldman Sachs. Now, other governments are doing it with other banks. This was the big one. They were taking money out of these central banks and out of their treasuries, converting it into other currencies like yen, and taking it back with Goldman showing a massive loss of several billion euro.
Now, why would Goldman want to lose money?
Oh, Goldman doesn't lose money. No, Goldman, no. Giant Squid does not in the business of losing money deliberately. It was a scam. They were secretly set up to get the money back with high interest, and they got a fee of nearly a third of $1 billion. Not, you know, flim-flam ain't cheap these days. The problem is, when the flim got flammed and it was exposed, then holders of the junk paper, the Greek paper, said, we've been defrauded. The deficit's bigger than anyone imagined. And now we're going to charge you through the wazoo if you want to borrow again. And now the average Greek family's paying $14,000 a year in interest payments.
Well, this all was done through a conservative government.
And so,
doesn't this go against
a bit, actually, true.
And then Papandreou mm-hmm. joined in on this?
Yeah, not Papandreou, but his socialist predecessor. So you had both governments. Papandreou walked in and found out what happened. He didn't talk about the Goldman scam, just that there was this huge deficit left by the prior government that was hidden. He didn't mention the Goldman scam because his own party was in it. And in other words, both parties were involved in this trickery.
Well, you have been a supporter of Occupy Wall Street, mm-hmm. And one of the complaints that some of the people down there have made is that they're being arrested, and Lloyd Blankfein and other major figures in this kind of activity are still living great lives.
Well, two reasons. One, they should be read their rights. Before I was an investigative reporter, I was an investigator. I did racketeering cases for the government. And, you know, in the old Spitzer days and when Giuliani actually had a soul, you would go into these Wall Street buildings, read them their rights, and march them out. This is a massive fraud upon the market. This is the definition of racketeering that's going on here. I don't know why they haven't been nailed and why they get bonuses instead of hard time. However, the general trend, we call it deregulating banks. As I explained in the book, this is decriminalizing banks, and I go through how they do it. And the big complaint, by the way, when you talk about Occupy Wall Street, kind of Vulture's Picnic is kind of a investigation of that 1%, okay, is how the system is fixed. And you can't just go back to Greece with this one Goldman scam. That's an end of a process, okay, of decriminalizing, deregulating the banking system, which was forced, jammed down the throats of Greeks and others who knew better by basically bullying by an agreement between Goldman, Bank of America, Citibank, Tim Geithner, and Larry Summers. Tim, who is our current Secretary of Treasury, and Summers, who was economics czar. And you see in the book this document in which they're discussing their plan to use trade as a weapon to beat the hell out of any country that doesn't go along with the deregulation madness.
And where did you get that document?
I can't tell you where I got it, but I can tell you how I authenticated it. I got about 5,000 documents from inside the World Bank, the IMF, and the World Trade Organization. I took some of these to Joe Stiglitz, who I think you know, won the Nobel Prize. He was head of the chief economist of the World Bank. I've known him a long time. And Joe would never give me a document, but he authenticated the World Bank documents to authenticate this weird memo between Geithner and Summers about the banks coming up with a plan to wreck economies that don't let them in. I had to go actually to the head of the World Trade Organization himself, a guy called the Generalissimo of Globalization, Pascal Lamy, a French banker, who says, oh, there's no cabal of evil bankers and meeting in secret. And I said, well, then what's this document? And what's this document? What's this document? Of course, he doesn't deny it. He just starts talking it away. So he authenticated documents for me. And I take those documents, then I fly off to Ecuador to give it to the president of Ecuador.
Well, we'll get to Ecuador in just a moment, but were you surprised when Timothy Geithner and Lawrence Summers were named to those posts in the Obama administration?
No. Were you? In fact, they were named before Obama was elected, because clearly within a couple days of being elected, suddenly it's Summers and Geithner, basically the Robert Rubin gang. These are the typhoid Marys of economics. These are the guys that brought the world to its knees with this deregulation.
But didn't they work well during the Clinton administration?
They worked well for them during the Clinton administration. For Robert Rubin, you see the story, of course, and this is – well, most of this book is my deep investigations. This one's fairly well known, but it required repeating, which is that Robert Rubin was at the center – of tearing down the wall between the casino banks, the investment banks, commercial banks, your piggy banks, and allowing commercial banks then to go play with your money in Vegas with a government guarantee. 6 months after doing that deed as Secretary of Treasury, he goes over and becomes co-chairman of Citibank and this new combined monster. It goes bankrupt. We give them $40 billion, and he gets a bonus of $110 million.
And Barack Obama wanted to break up the Citigroup. But Timothy Geithner just ignored his request.
Yeah, and we know who's in charge then, don't we?
Well, that's what you say. Greg Palast, his latest book is called Vulture's Picnic: In Pursuit of Petroleum Pigs, Power Pirates, and High Finance Carnivores. It is published by Dutton. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Can we go back to the petroleum pigs for a moment? Because there's been a lot of talk about pipelines in this country, and the Alaskan pipeline, and then this new one that has become very controversial. Would they all be using these petroleum pigs?
By law, they have to. That's what scares me. In other words, you got this robot pig, and that's the only thing that keeps us safe. Because you have to. The only way to test the pipeline is from the inside. From the outside, it just looks like any piece of plumbing. The problem is pressure leaks, corrosion, breaking, rust. And so every pipeline must have a robot pig go through it by law. And the laws are really thick. You know, I got to tell you something, Lenny, is that the right wing especially is very big on there's too many laws. And Al Gore was in on this. Oh, the thick rule books. You know what? When a pipeline explodes, you want the thickest rule book between you and that explosion. The software engineers who did the fix and silenced the pig with software – so it wouldn't squeal, and this is causing death, leaks. They told me, okay, that they showed me the very specific regulations. This would apply to the XL pipeline, and it's the same that they're going to put down. Say, don't worry, this is safe. Look at our regulations. Yeah, of course, unless you're jacking with the regulations. That's the problem, and I found out about this actually by a tip-off when I was up in the Arctic. To try to find out why there are massive spills at BP's Trans-Alaska pipeline, which is the hint that things are going way bad.
Now, this is something that's also come up in the Republican candidates' debates last night. I think it was Rick Perry who suggested that we just freeze all the assets of the Iranian National Bank, and others have pointed out, although none of the people in the debate pointed out, that if that happened, then oil... a large amount of oil would stop flowing and that would drive up prices. But one of the candidates also said that we can replace all of that with our own domestic oil reserves.
Yeah, at what price? Now, here's the,
Is that even possible? Is there that much oil in
Yeah, I don't doubt that. But that's not the point. By the way, Rick, it's because of that, Rick Perry called me last night, and he asked me to change the book from Vulture's Picnic to Job Creator's Picnic. But what happened?
Obviously, a joke. Okay, there's somebody out there who's going to take that.
I know.
That,
you have no idea. Right? What? Yeah. Oh, that's amazing. Rick Perry. There's a lot of jokes in the book, but it's a lot of serious good reporting. Now, what's happened there? It depends what you want. You want to move a whale? I mean, the problem is that Obama, just in August, as of finishing the book, agreed to allow drilling off the coast of the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. And I'd gotten this message to go up to the Arctic by the Eskimo chief. Actually, I got this message that said from the chief of intelligence of the Free Republic of the Arctic. I thought it was a joke to go to this island Kaktovik above the Arctic Circle. And then it turned out to be real. But this was like the chief of the Etok is the leader of the Eskimo up there. And he said, that's the end of us. You know, whales do not like swimming in oil any more than you do. And then he used language. He wanted me to take a message to my queen because of British Petroleum. I'm British Broadcasting. And he suggested that she stick her oil well. And I said, I told him it was anatomically impossible, but I'd carry the message anyway.
So you spoke to the Etok in Alaska. Mm-hmm. He also spoke to the Kofan Indians. Where do they live?
In the middle of the rainforest in the Amazon. After
how do they connect to the story?
Well, PBS did an investigation of Deepwater Horizon. They said that it's BP's culture, unlike Chevron. They had the president of Chevron on the petroleum broadcast system. And he said, we don't do these things. So I had to investigate. BBC sent me into the rainforest in Ecuador. And they said, well, we heard that there is massive poisoning and dumping of oil by Chevron's Texaco unit there. No one's checking it out. I mean, so I went there. So I had to go. They said, there, by the way, there'd be a boat waiting for me. And there's a segment where I'm waiting for my boat. You know, and I thought Humphrey Bogart and the African Queen would come down. So they say, Sue Barco, it's a cutout, you know, dugout log with a hand-carved paddle. And thank God some guy came out of the rainforest, an indigenous person, took me across. But what we find there, I meet the chief of the Kofan natives, who very formally shows up in war paint, you know, for this formal taking on of Chevron. And the kids are covered in pustules. It's just awful.
There's been a documentary made of this, which has led actually for the filmmakers to wind up having to pay some fines.
Well, they were because they didn't want to give up their film to Chevron. Mm-hmm. So they would rather pay fines and give up their back film. And, you know, this is an important story. What I did, I was able to do that they couldn't do, is I was able to reach Chevron, which said to me, their lawyers say to me, and you see in the book, well, are these the only kids who get cancer from oil? How can you prove it's our oil? There's no documents. So I end up showing them a document written by the president of Texaco himself saying, take the documents regarding dumping of oil out of the file cabinets in the offices and in the countryside encampments. And these documents, it's in Spanish, are to be destruidos. You don't need a lot of Spanish to know that he's saying destroy the documents. I handed that to Chevron. They said, there's got to be an explanation. It's 2 years ago. I'm waiting for the explanation, Lenny. Where's destroying documents?
One of the things we'd like to believe is that these oil companies are in competition with each other. But you say that they work together to share blame on big disasters.
Yeah, well, you know, that, for example, Exxon took the hit for the Exxon Valdez. Their name was on the ship, schmucks. You're not supposed to do that. Don't put your name on the ship. It could go wrong. But the real culprit, there's a 4-volume investigation in detail saying that the emergency equipment that was supposed to be right there where the ship hit wasn't there, that it was all a lie, that there was no system for controlling that oil. And that was BP in that 4 volumes. Now, I know about those 4 volumes of the investigation, which were confidential, because I wrote them. I was the key investigator, chief investigator of the fraud allegations in that case. So BP was given a pass. And it's like they say, okay, it's Exxon's turn, and now it's BP's turn, even though, for example, in the Gulf, you have to understand, when Chevron says, oh, we wouldn't have done that, all the major oil companies share one single cleanup operation, one single spill prevention operation. They were all responsible, all of them.
Just one more thing before you go. Your writing has been called pulp nonfiction. How did you come to this approach?
Yeah, Bobby Kennedy called it pulp nonfiction. I think that's correct because I wanted people in, unlike my last books, which is just the results of investigation. I want you to come with me, be on the stakeouts, be with me when I get the cables, and be with me when I totally screw up and like I get arrested in Azerbaijan because I, you know, I'm an idiot. Okay, I lose the James Bond award once a week. You should see this stuff. Be with me. So it feels, you know, if you read it, it's, you know, it looks like Raymond Chandler, except it actually happens.
Greg Palast's latest book is Vulture's Picnic, In Pursuit of Petroleum Pigs, Power Pirates, and High Finance Carnivores. It's published by Dutton. And the ebook comes with an interactive video. You can also find that at gregpalast.com.
Well, gregpalast.com, and I'll be
I'll be talking about that in a moment.
Okay.
Okay. Thank you so much for being on our show.